Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
And I'm Gail Harris. Coming up, the Palestinian prime minister threatens to quit Fatah.
While in Washington, Congress moves to give federal employees more complete medical benefits than the rest of us will get under Medicare.
It's not that they're Cadillac benefits by any means. They're, you know, the federal insurance plan is actually quite a typical plan that you see that any worker would get at their workplace.
Also, a novel by an Afghan-American about fathers, sons, innocence and betrayal, and life under the Taliban.
These stories and berry and peach cake on the menu coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. In South Africa today, President Bush was again pressed on the issue of whether the United States will send troops to Liberia as part of an international peacekeeping force. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Pretoria, the second stop on President's five-nation African trip.
The president says he still has not decided if U.S. troops will be sent into Liberia. Speaking to reporters in Pretoria, he was asked if it's possible U.S. forces already stationed in Iraq, Afghanistan, Kosovo, and elsewhere are being spread too thin. Mr. Bush's response?
First, my answer to people is that we won't overextend our troops, period.
The president added that the U.S. will be involved in peacekeeping in Liberia, but said he'll determine what that means after hearing from a U.S. assessment team currently inside the country. He again stated that it's important that Liberia's President Charles Taylor leave office so a peaceful transition of power can begin. Don Gagne, NPR News in Pretoria.
Crowds in Liberia thronged that team of U.S. military experts today. The team visited an airfield. Liberian soldiers kept the crowds away as the U.S. team looked into the airfield's facilities to see if it could be used as a stop to fly in relief supplies and other materials. As many as 400 people are feared drowned after an overcrowded ferry capsized last night in a Bangladesh river. NPR's Michael Sullivan has more.
Officials say the ferry sank in rough water southeast of the capital, Dhaka, at approximately the same spot where a ferry went down in May of last year, killing nearly 500 people. Local newspapers say the ferry involved in this accident was carrying nearly double its legal limit after taking on some 400 passengers from another ferry which had canceled its scheduled trip. Local officials say nearly 200 people were either rescued or able to swim to safety. Ferry accidents occur all too frequently in Bangladesh, especially at this time of year, with the arrival of monsoon rains that swell the rivers and create unpredictable currents. Critics say poor maintenance and lax enforcement of existing regulations are also factors in many ferry accidents. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, New Delhi.
Weather forecasters say tropical storm Claudette has lost a little steam. Top winds have been clocked at 65 miles per hour. Storm warnings are still up in Jamaica and in the Cayman Islands. Forecasters at the National Hurricane Center say they do not believe Claudette will gain hurricane status, winds measured at more than 74 miles per hour. Claudette is currently predicted to cross the Mexican Yucatan Peninsula and then blow into the Gulf of Mexico over the weekend. Forecasters say people along the Gulf Coast should continue to monitor the storm's progress closely. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 113 points at 9109. The Nasdaq is down 10 at 1735. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the number of people across the nation applying for home loans dipped slightly last week. Carrie Nolan of member station WNYC has more.
Demand for mortgages as well as home loan refinancings was slower than in weeks past when interest rates on 30-year fixed-rate loans dropped to 40-year lows. Industry analysts blame last week's slight downturn on two factors, the 4th of July holiday weekend and a relatively tiny climb in the interest rate from just under 5.25% to just over 5.33%. And while rates are up slightly, borrowing costs remain low enough to encourage home buying as well as refinancings. The Mortgage Bankers Association of America said its measure of demand for refinancings fell 21.3%, while its gauge of demand for loans to buy a home, the purchase index, fell 5.5%. For NPR News, I'm Carrie Nolan.
Hospital company Tenet Healthcare says it is being investigated by the federal government. The Securities and Exchange Commission started an informal inquiry last November into its billing for expensive medical procedures. Now, Tenet says the SEC has expanded that inquiry into a formal investigation. Tenet's already being sued by the Justice Department. A published report says two tobacco companies have talked about merging. The Wall Street Journal reports R.J. Reynolds Company and Brown & Williamson have discussed joining forces. The paper adds both companies are struggling with competition, especially from rival Philip Morris. Any merger would require a lot of talks with regulators. Both R.J. Reynolds and Brown & Williamson together control about a third of the U.S. tobacco market. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Enterprise Florida, the economic development partnership for Florida, helping grow Florida's innovation economy. On the web at eflorida.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris. Robin Young is out today.
It's Here and Now.
Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas has quit the Central Committee of Fatah, the movement he founded 40 years ago with Yasser Arafat. Whether it's a shrewd political move or a walkout by an exhausted politician is hard to tell. But one thing seems clear. When the roadmap to peace suffers any setbacks these days, it is Abbas, also known as Abu Mazen, more than any Israeli or other Arab figure, who's been taking it on the chin lately. Well, John Anderson is Jerusalem correspondent for The Washington Post and a frequent guest on our program. He joins us from Jerusalem. Hello, John.
Hi, Gail. How are you?
Good, thanks. Well, let's start with some setbacks, because just days after the latest ceasefire was declared, yesterday, Islamic Jihad said that it was responsible for a bomb blast on Monday that killed a 65-year-old Israeli woman, also injured three of her grandchildren. So here they are. They've just declared a ceasefire. They signed on to it. Ceasefire over?
The ceasefire is very tenuous, and there are a lot of cells out there, not just from Islamic Jihad, but most worryingly for Abu Mazen, from his own militant group, the Al-Aqsa Martyr Brigades, that are radical and don't agree to the terms of the ceasefire. Now, the leadership of Islamic Jihad, the group that declared responsibility for the bomb blast on Monday, says that this was a cell that was out of their control, that they did not give it permission to do this, and that they didn't sanction the bomb blast on Monday. There are a lot of groups out there that simply are beyond the control of their leadership. They've been radicalized by 33 months of bloodshed here in the Middle East.
Mm. So, John, what do you make of this resignation by Abu Mazen from Fatah as a member of the group? He co-founded it. I mean, what's the point? Was this a bluff, or is he sending us a signal here?
Well, I think it could be both. I don't think he ever intended to leave Fatah, and in fact, Fatah has not accepted his resignation. If, in fact, they did accept his resignation, it would clearly lead to a vote of no confidence almost immediately, and his government would collapse. There's been just a huge amount of complaint, internal sniping, backstabbing from within Fatah. So this is his attempt to try and rally some support behind his more moderate policies.
Now, of course, the big issue right now seems to be over the release of Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails. And in fact, that was the reason that was given by Islamic Jihad for the bombing on Monday, that not enough prisoners are being freed. But it's so interesting because this isn't even part of the roadmap that everyone's supposed to be following.
It wasn't part of the roadmap, but it was central to the whole question of a ceasefire that Abu Mazen negotiated with the radical Palestinian groups. As part of that, the Palestinian groups said, hey, we want Israel to release all of the Palestinian prisoners who are now locked up in Israeli jails. There have been a variety of gestures that Israel has made to keep the peace process moving forward. But Palestinians say that many of those gestures are not really felt on the streets, and that one of the things that Israel could do that would really be felt by Palestinian families and that would be recognized as a huge gesture for peace would be to release some of these prisoners that they've been holding.
We're also hearing, John, today that the United States is going to resume direct financial aid to the Palestinian Authority. How important is that?
Well, the thing about U.S. support is that it comes with a significant downside, too. You must remember that Abu Mazen was not elected. He doesn't have a popular mandate from the Palestinian people. And so he is perceived, rightly or wrongly, as a creature of the United States and as a creature of Israel. And so every time the United States helps him, it reinforces the idea that he's a U.S. stooge, even though, on the other hand, he desperately needs the support and the money and the symbolism that's involved with the U.S. finally giving direct aid to the Palestinian Authority is very important.
Well, how's he going to be able to pull through this, or is it even possible?
You know, this is going to be particularly difficult. He's not an elected politician, and, you know, sometimes his instincts for politics are proven not to be very good. And he's going to have a really, really tough time. Arafat is a master of politics. Sharon is a master of politics, and he's going to have a really, really tough time keeping pace with these guys and making sure he is an empowered prime minister who is able to wheel and deal with Israel on the one hand and keep the Palestinian street calm and stop the violence on the other.
And it almost seems as if the only weapon he has is to either go storming out of meetings or threaten to quit or then actually quit, as he has now.
That right now is just about the only weapon he has. He does not have a lot of support on the Palestinian street. It's not like, you know, Hamas can snap their fingers and they can get 50,000 people demonstrating down the streets of Gaza. In the most recent public opinion polls, Abu Mazen, the Palestinian prime minister, has a support of 1.8% of the people. And with that kind of support, there's very little maneuvering room in his dealings with the U.S. and particularly with Sharon and the Israelis.
Well, finally, if the Palestinian public mood is still deeply unhappy, how are Israelis feeling these days?
I think Israelis see a ray of hope, but there's not a huge amount of euphoria that there's going to be drastic change. Most Israelis, the polls show, believe that this is not going to lead to a permanent ending of hostilities. But I think at this point, they're willing at least to follow the roadmap down the path a little ways and see where it takes them.
Well, John, thank you so much.
Okay, Gail, thank you.
John Anderson is a Jerusalem correspondent for The Washington Post.
When it comes to the prescription drug benefits for seniors we've all heard so much about, we know this much. There will be such a benefit after years of talking about it. Lawmakers in Washington are working out the final details. But the devil, of course, is in those details. And yesterday, the House of Representatives passed a related bill that would guarantee retired federal workers the same level of drug benefits current federal workers receive. And those benefits are about twice the level of drug coverage Medicare recipients will likely end up receiving under new legislation now moving through Congress. That's raising some eyebrows. Well, joining me on the line from Atlanta, Georgia, is Kenneth Thorpe. He's chairman of the Health Policy Department at Emory University. And welcome, Professor Thorpe.
Well, thank you.
Professor Thorpe, we're getting this right, are we not? The House yesterday worked to assure that federal workers, including, of course, congressmen and women and the president himself, will continue to receive the level of prescription drug benefit they receive now, which will be a lot more than what most other average people would get under Medicare under the bills Congress is contemplating.
Yes, that's correct. Under the federal health plan, if you enroll in the most popular plan there, the Blue Cross Blue Shield program, that plan would pay about 80% of your drug costs, you know, for a typical person. And in the proposals going through the Congress right now, those plans would pay, you know, approximately half of the drug costs. In addition, you'd have to pay a premium of about $35 a month. So the current Medicare debate is over less generous drugs than what is currently available in the federal health plan.
Well, as kind of a health policy expert, what do you make of this two-tier system?
Well, it goes back to the basics, and that's the priorities over the allocation of resources in the federal budget. To make this plan more generous, it would cost perhaps another $300 billion over the next 10 years.
In other words, to raise the Medicare plan being contemplated for most people to the level of the federal plan, they'd have to spend $300 billion more than is already contemplated.
That's correct. And the federal plan, by the way, includes drug benefits that are fairly typical of what you'd find in the private insurance market. So it's not that they're Cadillac benefits by any means. The federal insurance plan is actually quite a typical plan that you see that any worker would get at their workplace.
So what do you make of the plan being contemplated for most people? Is it generous enough? Is it realistic enough to meet people's needs?
Well, that's going to be the debate. I've had concerns from the get-go that, $400 billion was going to be a difficult amount of money to shoehorn a drug benefit into. So I think, as you mentioned, the devil's in the details, and while I remain optimistic we can get something out of this conference, certainly there's going to be a lot of areas of contention between the conferees.
Yeah, the Senate and the House going into conference to try to come up with a final bill. Explain something to me. If someone's receiving through their corporation or the company that they work for at this point a prescription drug benefit, in most cases, does that prescription drug benefit continue after they retire under the company?
Well, that used to be the case, but it's increasingly not the case. For the ones that do have retiree health benefits, they are generally more generous than the drug benefits embedded in the Medicare proposals.
I see. So after the conference and after a prescription drug benefit is added to Medicare, what percentage of retirees do you think will wind up using the Medicare benefits as opposed to carrying on plans that they've had during their working life?
Well, I think most of them would prefer to stay in the plans that they have through their employers. I think the issue is going to be how many employers carve that benefit out or drop that coverage entirely. And I think that, anywhere from a third to 40% of current retirees who get private benefits today may have those plans dropped in favor of the Medicare drug benefit.
I see. So, in other words, the Medicare drug benefit is an incentive for companies to drop plans for their retirees.
Well, that's right. It's certainly a lot cheaper for an employer to simply pay the estimated premium of about $35 a month, or have the employee simply pay the $35 a month.
I see. So is that a good thing to encourage companies not to look after their former employees insofar as prescription drug benefits are concerned?
That's been one of the major points of contention, and certainly previous attempts at reforming Medicare have had provisions in it that would provide financial incentives for employers to retain their employment-based coverage.
What kind of incentives are those?
Well, they would be financial incentives. Basically, that they would, the federal government would essentially reimburse employers a certain amount of money if they kept their benefits at a certain level.
Uh-huh.
Medicare would end up spending less, and beneficiaries who stay in their employment-based plans would get better benefits.
Well, just to finish up then, would you mind prognosticating a little? What kind of a bill do you think the Senate and House will finally come up with?
Well, that's going to be difficult to say because there are many different parts of this legislation. There are also some very substantial reforms with respect to how HMOs are paid for their services in the Medicare program. And I think that's going to be certainly one of the flashpoints in the debate.
Professor Kenneth Thorpe, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Kenneth Thorpe is chairman of the Health Policy Department at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia.
Just ahead, The Kite Runner, a novel of Afghanistan and life under the Taliban.
And later in the show, how airlines are doing and the new smart seat.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The new novel, The Kite Runner, is a story of two Afghan boys and about fathers and sons. It's also a book about innocence, betrayal, and a struggle for redemption. Set against the tumultuous recent history of Afghanistan, including the rise and fall of the Taliban, it's also a story that sprawls to the west coast of the United States, where the book's Afghan-American author now lives. The Kite Runner is the first novel by Khaled Hosseini, and Khaled now joins me in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Khaled, even before we get to what the book's about and what the heck a kite runner might be, tell me about yourself.
Well, I'm the oldest of five. I was born in Kabul. My father was a diplomat working in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and my mother was a high school teacher. And we ended up leaving Afghanistan in 1976 for Paris for what we thought was going to be a four-year stint in the Afghan embassy in Paris, where my father was stationed.
Now, the main character of the book, Amir, there are similarities to the story you just told me and dissimilarities. Can you sort of parse them out for us a little bit? He also comes from a well-off family. He also eventually goes to the United States.
Right. I think in a general, broad sense, our lives do parallel each other that way. The character and I are about the same age. We're born in the mid-1960s, and we lived in Afghanistan in the good old days. I actually left Afghanistan before the communist coup, and Amir leaves Afghanistan soon after the communist coup. And we both came to the States in the early 1980s as immigrants.
Those good old days are, well, almost a character in the book. I think a lot of people may not realize what a even serene place Afghanistan was before the Soviets invaded. This is a book about a childhood friendship. Tell me about that, between a wealthy boy and his servant.
Yes, Amir is a Pashtun, and that is the majority ethnicity in Afghanistan, and he is a son of a wealthy merchant. And Hassan is his servant, and he's the same age. And he is a Hazara, which is a oppressed minority ethnicity in Afghanistan. And it's the dynamics of that unusual and deep friendship that really triggers the plot for this book.
What is a kite runner?
In Afghanistan, we don't just fly kites, we fight them. It's a common form of entertainment for boys. The way it's done is you coat your string with ground glass and glue, and you fly your kite way up, and the objective is to cut the other guy's kite. And then the kite runners are those kids who then run through the streets and try to chase down the kite that's been defeated and is coming down.
What's the significance of kites in this book?
Amir has a very difficult relationship with his father. His father
Baba.
Is Baba, who is this flamboyant, larger-than-life character. Or Amir is reclusive and in awe of his father, and he's trying to impress his dad. And they're very different people, except that their spheres of existence intersect in this one little area, which is the kites. And it's also the way that Amir connects with Hassan.
The way Amir connects with Hassan. But Hassan is still very, very much his servant, and yet they forge this very strong bond and love that eventually is shattered. I don't want to give the book away, but
yeah,
how unusual would it have been in Afghanistan then for a young wealthy boy to have a friendship with his servant?
It would not be unusual to sort of be friendly between master and servant. But I think what is unusual is that they really belong to different classes in that society, and they really occupy polar ends of that hierarchy. And to have two people separated by that be this close, I think would be a little unusual.
So much of this book, which again starts out with this kind of almost paradise for a boy, endless streets to fly kites on, and the beautiful snow in the winter, and the pomegranate trees in the summer. So much of this book is about the shattering of that world, just as Afghanistan itself has been shattered in the course of the life of Amir and in the course of your own life.
Yes. I mean, my personal memories of Afghanistan are really are very lyrical, They're very fond and almost romantic. The things that you alluded to, those are things lifted directly from what I, the Afghanistan rooted in my childhood memories. And of course, most of those things no longer exist. And Afghanistan is a vastly different place now than the one I recall.
Deep yearning and nostalgia throughout this book in the person of Amir for Afghanistan. You yourself didn't return to Afghanistan until, you said, I believe, March of this year.
Correct.
And at that time, you'd already written the book, which is interesting because in the book, the main character has already gone back to Afghanistan.
Yes.
How did you react to seeing your city as it looks now?
I found Kabul to be a mosaic of things that are truly beautiful and things that are downright horrific right next to each other. There is beauty at every corner in the way people simply don't give up and in the way people are going about their lives and in the way they've maintained their hopes and integrity. Yet, at every single block in Kabul, there is somehow some scar of war, somebody who's mutilated. There's no escaping the aftermath of all these years of war. So it was very difficult to see those things. But I came away with a profound sense of admiration for the Afghan people.
Khalid Hosseini, it's such a rich book. We could talk for another long while, but we have to wrap it up now. I want to thank you so much, both for joining us here in the studio and also for writing a book that I thought was wonderful and recommend to any of our listeners.
I'm touched. Thank you.
Khalid Hosseini is author of the book, The Kite Runner.
On Here and Now, smart mobs, a new way of organizing everything from warfare to protests to presidential campaigns.
And in Hong Kong, protesters continue to rally against an anti-subversion law. Could Hong Kong's relative freedoms now filter into China? That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, summer is traditionally the busiest time for the airlines, but is there any light at the end of the tunnel for some of the most troubled carriers?
The airlines that have not been in Chapter 11 are also very highly leveraged. They're running out of things they can borrow against. If and when they become profitable, they're going to need years of profitability just to get their balance sheets back in order. It's a very dangerous situation for them.
And speaking of flying, the latest technology in airline seating.
These stories and very, very good cake coming up Here and Now.
I'm Dolores Handy. President Bush is in South Africa on the second day of his tour of the African continent. He says the U.S. is directing some of its efforts towards achieving peace, as well as providing funds for the fight against AIDS.
We're also committed to helping African nations achieve peace. In Liberia, the United States strongly supports the ceasefire agreement signed last month. President Taylor needs to leave Liberia so that his country can be spared further grief and bloodshed.
The president still is not promising to send U.S. peacekeeping troops to Liberia, but he says if he does, he will make sure he does not overextend the U.S. military. The U.S. military says it has captured Saddam Hussein's former interior minister and the leader of the Ba'ath Party. The U.S. now reportedly has 34 of its 55 most wanted Iraqi officials with the capture of the two men. And despite recent attacks on U.S. forces, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld says most of Iraq is secure. Rumsfeld tells the Senate Armed Services Committee it would be wrong to assume that those carrying out attacks on troops are operating freely in Iraq. Terrorism experts are insisting that the 9/11 attacks resulted from a failure of U.S. leadership as well as U.S. intelligence. Rohan Gunatratna, the head of terrorism research at the Institute for Defense and Strategic Studies in Singapore, says U.S. leaders knew of the dangers posed by Al-Qaeda terror network.
You knew that the intention of Al-Qaeda was to kill American people wherever they could be found, but still you did not act. And therefore, you paid a very heavy price for it.
He was the first in a series of experts testifying at the third public hearing of a panel looking into the attacks. An elementary school vice principal wanted for questioning in the deaths of five of his family members is now in custody. 41-year-old Vincent Brothers surrendered to police in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, just after midnight last night. Police want to question him about the deaths of his mother-in-law, wife, and three young children in Bakersfield, California. The Bush administration is urging Congress to provide more protections against identity theft. Treasury Secretary John Snow, appearing before the House Financial Services Committee, urged lawmakers to strengthen the nation's credit laws to make it harder for thieves to steal other people's identities. On Wall Street at this hour, stocks are down 98 points at 91.25.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Well, the war in Iraq is officially declared over. The CDC believes SARS is now contained, and the world is slowly recovering from the shock of 9/11, all of which should be positive news for the airline industry, which has been hard hit over the past couple of years by what one airline official called the perfect storm. But industry watchers say that airlines are not rebounding quickly enough, and several carriers have either gone under or are still struggling to stave off bankruptcy. Well, joining us to take the temperature of the nation's airlines this midsummer is David Bond, senior transport editor at Aviation Week magazine. Welcome, David.
Hello.
Let's start with the current seeming crisis with airlines, because in that kind of situation, you might expect to see lower fares to draw in more customers, but that doesn't appear to be happening. Why not?
Well, in part it is, in part it isn't. You see lower fares being offered as promotions and trying to bring passengers back. You see lower fares being offered by carriers that are in bankruptcy protection or threatened with it as ways of keeping their customers rather than losing them to someone else. Where lower fare carriers like Southwest, JetBlue, AirTran, others are in a market, you'll see the bigger airlines matching those low fares to be competitive. But where an airline does not have to lower a fare, it won't.
What about business travel? Is that also flagging?
Very much. It started really about 2 years ago in the spring of 2001, before 9/11. The dot-com boom, the telecommunications boom of the late 90s was pretty much over, and business people weren't traveling as much. They were more careful about how much they spent on fares. When they did badly in the second quarter of 2001, they knew they were in trouble, and then September 11 came on top of it. At that point, people simply didn't want to travel at all.
Now, this summer, which is usually a very busy travel time, we're hearing a lot of anecdotal evidence about what seemed to be fuller airplanes, but is that a sign of increased travel, or is the airline industry generally grounding planes and cramming as many people as they can into whatever planes they are flying?
It's the second thing that you just said. They've grounded a lot of airplanes. They are filling the airplanes much more than they used to, but not at high fares. So this doesn't get them out of their hole. They need revenue. You don't get revenue by filling fewer airplanes to a greater degree unless the fares are higher, and the fares are not higher. Something to think about. After September 11, the first thing the airlines did, they knew they were going to have to get through the winter. They immediately went and borrowed a bunch of money, because that's a period of the year in which they lose money in a typical situation. They immediately scaled back their operations. They laid off a lot of people. They grounded a lot of airplanes. They reduced their costs. But they took on debt, and they've been doing it ever since. Once they got through the winter of 2001-02, I don't think any of them expected to make money during 2002. The next step was to get through the winter of 2002-03. That they have done. Now, in the meantime, U.S. Airways went into Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. They came out of it March 31st. Last December, United went into Chapter 11. So this has not been a totally successful thing. The airlines that have not been in Chapter 11 are also very highly leveraged. They're running out of things they can borrow against. They're leveraged to the hilt. If and when they become profitable, they're going to need years of profitability just to get their balance sheets back in order. It's a very dangerous situation for them, fiscally.
Well, David, thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
David Bond is Senior Transport Editor at Aviation Week magazine. And while we're on the topic of airlines, does flying make you nervous, cause your blood pressure to rise? Do you get fidgety after you've been in the air for a while? Or might you be at risk for thrombosis because you sit very still for long periods of time? Well, even if you're not sure, soon someone may be, thanks to scientists in Britain who are developing the Smart Seat, a seat whose features have implications for passengers' health, comfort, and security. Joining me on the line is Dr. Robert Coppard. He is project leader for Kinetics Aircraft Cabin Interior Business. Hello, Dr. Coppard.
Hi there, Gail.
You have to tell us how this works because it sounds fascinating.
Okay. What we have, Gail, is some sensor technologies embedded into a concept aircraft seat, and we're using that to measure physical information about the occupant of that seat. So at the moment, we're looking at simple measurements such as lower body motion, upper body movement, whole body movement. We're looking to introduce other sensor capabilities in the future, near future. Things like, does a passenger have their seatbelt done up? If they do have their seatbelt done up, is it actually around their waist? Information that can be of value to the flight crew and tell them more about the physical state of the passenger and the occupant of that seat.
And even, I understand, it will turn off the light if you fall asleep?
That's one of our ideas. If someone hasn't moved for a period of time, but they've got their seatbelt done up, they're sitting in the seat, probably quite safe to assume that they've fallen asleep. We would say, well, they don't need the lights on. Let's turn the lights off. So what we're trying to do is to create an adaptive environment, one that tells the flight crew more information about the passengers.
Now, what about the application for air quality on board? Because one of the things that many people don't like about flying is it seems as if the air is so stale.
That's right, and every time you get off a long-haul flight, you wonder whether you've got a cold and if it came because of that flight. What we're interested in is not just being able to sterilize the environment, but also how can we introduce the right sort of aromas that might act physiologically, psychologically with people in order to help relax them, you know, sort of onboard aromatherapy.
What are the implications of this technology for health and security specifically?
In terms of health, SmartSeat is one of those technologies that might allow people to be more conscious of their state when they're flying and allow them to maintain a more healthy state. We see the air filtration system as being supportive of that as well in terms of cabin air quality. But what it's generally about is allowing people to relax and be less fatigued on their flight. And if they're less fatigued and they're more relaxed, by definition, they should be in a healthier state as well.
And if there was someone on a flight who might be a security risk, how might the SmartSeat point you toward that?
What we're looking there is, again, assessing the physical information on the state of the passenger. Now, we've talked about someone who may have fallen asleep. The opposite extreme is someone who is very agitated and they have a lot of very sudden movements. What it allows us to do is to alert the aircrew again to the fact that there is a passenger who is displaying very nervous behavior. It's then down to them to make a visual assessment. It's really providing that first alert status for aircrew, and that means they can use their time a lot better.
Thank you, Dr. Coppard.
You're welcome.
Dr. Robert Coppard is project leader for Kinetic's aircraft cabin interior business. He joined us on the line from the UK.
Still to come, cooking up a summertime cake full of fresh fruit with our in-house chef, Kathy Guntz.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Fires that raged across parts of Arizona and New Mexico last summer left devastated forests and many dream homes burned to the ground. But for all that, the fires around the Salt River in Arizona, local people say, weren't all bad when it comes to catfish. Joining us on the line to explain is Kieran Suckling, Executive Director of the Center for Biological Diversity in Tucson, Arizona. He joins us today from Santa Monica, California. And welcome, Kieran.
Hello, how are you?
Kieran, first off, catfish aren't native to the Southwest, right? How did they end up there?
Well, catfish, like actually several dozen other kinds of fish, were introduced to Arizona as game fish and as bait. And they have proceeded to take over virtually all of the rivers of Arizona, displacing and driving our native species to the edge of extinction.
Aha. Uh-huh. Now, when were they introduced and why were they introduced into Arizona rivers?
Well, they began introducing these in the 1920s and 30s, but to this day, to our chagrin, exotic species are still being introduced, some of them in order to be caught and eaten, like catfish. Others are for bait. Others have been put in with the mistaken notion that they would control mosquitoes.
Huh. Now, how voracious are these catfish?
Oh, they're quite incredible. They're like sharks of the riverways. They eat the other fish in the river. They'll eat bullfrogs, garter snakes, just about anything they come across. They're quite amazing.
But now it seems they've fallen on very hard times indeed in the wake of these fires. Can you explain?
Yes. Well, after the fire, you've got a lot of ash lying around. And then when the rains come, it washes that ash into the river. And that at that moment, virtually all of the catfish were wiped out from the river, which means now that with no exotics in that river, it provides an incredible opportunity to restore the endangered native species to the river.
So why did the ash wipe out the catfish?
Well, the ash wipes out the ability of the fish to breathe, and it wipes out the nesting habitat as well for a brief period of time. So it's a short shock to the system. The ash has now gone through the rivers in good condition.
But the catfish are gone.
but the catfish are gone. That's the good news. And it's really quite an amazing thing, because the presence of these exotic species is an enormous problem all over the country. And it's one that has been almost impossible for wildlife managers to deal with. It's incredibly difficult to get these exotics out of the streams. And when they do, it's typically just a little tiny headwater stream that's not of great value. And so it's only through the force of these enormous fires that Mother Nature has been able to drive these exotics out of entire river systems, which will give us the opportunity to give a leg up to the endangered native fish.
Kieran Suckling, thanks very much for joining us on this.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Kieran Suckling is the executive director of the Center for Biological Diversity in Tucson, Arizona.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
We're finally surrounded by an abundance of fresh summer fruits, but what do you do with them all? Here and Now's resident chef Kathy Gunst is making the most of the seasonal bounty with her mixed berry and peach cake from her kitchen in southern Maine.
Aside from just eating a huge bowl of fresh, ripe berries all by themselves, or maybe with a dash of heavy cream over them, I love to make a cake. And this isn't the time of year when you want to really spend a lot of time in the kitchen and have the oven on and get all hot. But this is a cake that is so simple. The whole process takes an hour, which is miraculous for a cake. It's the simplest of cake batters, and you blend a variety of fresh berries into the cake. I like to use blueberries and blackberries, strawberries and raspberries, and then you peel peaches and you put that into this batter, throw it all into a pan, pop it in the oven, go out for a swim, go out and take a walk, and come back and you'll have this gorgeous mixed berry and peach cake ready for eating. First step, we want to peel the peaches. And I have a great trick. This works with any type of stone fruit, plums, peaches, nectarine, apricots. It's really hard to peel a raw peach. So what you do is you get a pot of water and you bring it to a boil. And just before it comes to a boil, you get a bowl and you fill it with ice cubes and water. Grab a few ice cubes and just fill that bowl with water. What you're going to do is you're going to immerse the peach, it's called blanching, into the boiling water for about 30 seconds, 60 seconds. You're going to take it right out and throw it right into the ice-cold water. And the ice-cold water shocks it, and the fruit starts to shrink, and so the peel just comes right off. This is a great trick. Okay, my water's boiling. I'm going to lower the peaches in. Just kind of stir them around and just give it about 30 seconds. If they're large and they're not that ripe, you may need closer to a minute. But if they're very ripe and small, if they're tree ripe and beautiful peaches, they're only going to take about 30 seconds. Okay. Take the peach out with a little strainer spoon here and put it right into that ice water. Just let it sit in the ice water for a minute. And then you're going to use a small, sharp knife. You could use your fingers and just peel that skin right off. You can do it right in the bowl with the ice water. And as soon as you get the peel off, you're just going to take your peach out and cut it in half and remove the stone in the middle. That's why they're called stone fruits. The pit is also called the stone. Mm, the perfume of this peach is so wonderful. This is just such a great time of year for fruit. And you get the peel off, and you're going to cut them into thin slices. They don't need to be all perfect or the same, but you want them fairly thinly sliced because they're going to cook into the cake batter. Okay, so we've got three peaches that have been peeled and pitted and thinly sliced, and now we can make the cake batter. You want to use a handheld mixer or a standing mixer and take a stick of sweet butter and 1 cup of sugar. We're going to rely a lot on the sweetness of the peach and the berry, so 1 cup of sugar, it's not that much for a cup, but it should just do it. And we're going to mix those for about 10 minutes. This is why you definitely want an electric mixer. You want them to get light and fluffy. If you don't let it go the full 10 minutes, what happens is that the butter and the sugar don't get that light texture, and the cake tends to be heavier. So really let it go on medium speed for about 8 to 10 minutes. You want to start and stop the mixer every few minutes and just use a spatula to scrape it down so that all the butter and sugar come together. It's going to turn into sort of granules, and then it's going to come together. And you'll see the words light and fluffy will start to make sense after a few minutes. Okay, that's been about 9-10 minutes. I'm going to add a teaspoon of vanilla to the mixer while it's still on. And I'm going to add 2 eggs. You want to add eggs 1 at a time. You can crack them right in there. I'm going to beat it for another few minutes until the eggs are fully incorporated. And then I'm going to add 1.5 cups of cake flour. Cake flour, it's an enriched flour. It's supposed to give a cake really good volume and a great texture. If you don't have cake flour, you can use regular flour, but I would sift it 2, maybe 3 times. It lightens the flour up and it creates a really a lighter cake with a very good texture. All right, we've got our butter and sugar together with our 2 eggs, and now I'm going to slowly add 1.5 cups of cake flour. And I'm not turning the motor off. I'm just going to slowly add it and let it get incorporated just bit by bit. And then the last ingredient, believe it or not, before the fruit is 1.5 teaspoons of baking soda. Again, right into the batter. Take it out of the mixer here. And it's a quite thick batter at this point, but that's not a problem because when you add your berries and your peaches, the natural juices in the fruit are going to lighten it up. Okay, I'm going to fold the peach slices in, and then I'm going to add 3 cups of ripe berries. I've got plump, gorgeous blackberries, ripe raspberries, and then blueberries. They are so good for you. I mean, they're the ultimate food. They're low in calories. They have absolutely no fat, no sodium, and no cholesterol. Hey, what could be bad? And they're full of vitamin C and fiber, and they also have folic acid, so they're really considered a food that is quite excellent for you. If you're not picking berries, when you buy them, you want to make sure that you look at the bottom of the container. If that little piece of paper that they put underneath the berries in the plastic container has any color on it, that means the berries are old and they've leached their good flavor and color. You don't want those. You want plump, alive, fresh-looking berries. So I'm going to add 1 few raspberries and some blackberries. These are big, and oh, this is such a good time of year for blackberries. And then some blueberries. Obviously, you could add some sliced strawberries, too. And the more, the merrier. Gently fold. You don't want to bruise the fruit. Right now, this batter looks good enough to eat raw. We've got the orange peaches and the blackberries and the red, pink raspberries. And that's it. I'm not going to overfold it. And we're going to put that in our prepared pan. And we're going to put it in our preheated 350-degree oven for about 50 to 55 minutes. Go outside, enjoy the day, and you're going to come back to a gorgeous, gorgeous peach and berry cake. Okay, it's been 50 minutes. The kitchen smells like vanilla and berries and fresh fruit. And the way you test this cake is the way you test so many cakes. You put a toothpick right through the center And if it comes out clean, which it's done, it's ready. You can also just very lightly push your fingers down and make sure it doesn't feel soft anywhere. And that is beautiful. The fragrance of those peaches and the berries are really coming through. We're going to put that on a cake rack and let it cool completely before we pull the sides of the pan off. Now, the way I like to serve this cake is I like to sprinkle it with a little bit of confectioner's sugar. It's got a very nice golden brown color, but the white sugar, just take a very little sieve or sifter, place it over the cake, and sprinkle just the tiniest amount of confectioner's sugar in. And then we're going to take about another cup of berries, the same berries we used in the cake, the raspberries, the blackberries, and the blueberries, and we're going to pile them either on top of the cake just before serving. Do not put the fruit on way ahead of time because the juices will seep down into the cake and it can ruin it. Or you can garnish your plate by putting the berries around it. This is a wonderful cake for the summer to serve with an ice-cold glass of iced tea, garnished with a fresh mint leaf. It can be dessert. It would be fabulous for brunch. I think you get the idea. You could serve this cake any time of day. It's light enough, but all those fruit flavors just come shining through. And it is a real tribute to summer fruit.
Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Gunst. For Kathy's mixed berry and peach cake recipe, check out our website at here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.